guys. Welcome back to Wine, Crime, and TV Time. I'm Kaylee.
And I'm Emily.
And today we have another true crime episode for you guys. So yeah, today we're going to be talking about three different cases that all mix into one.
I'm so excited for this.
Which is very wild and interesting.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about this?
I do. I mean, like, not as much as you, because this was your thing.
Naturally.
But yeah, I did read up on it. And I'm actually, like, very, very excited for this because I was very confused by some parts of it. I had to, like, reread a lot because I was so confused.
It gets very confusing, I feel
like. I'm like, what?
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
And that's why I texted you last night. And I was like, oh, she's crazy.
I watched the Dateline episode last night. And first of all, it's a 2-hour Dateline episode.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's really long. But it just kept, like, I remember watching it before, too, but, like, I don't know if it was, like, older or something. Like, I didn't have all of the information, but it just kept going and going and going, and I was like, I wonder if this ever ends for this woman. Man, woman, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
It's a surprise.
Ooh.
All right. So let's get into it.
We should talk about what we're drinking, too.
Oh, I totally forgot. I know. I just thought about that right now. So what are you drinking today?
Today I'm drinking Yingling.
Are you really?
Yeah.
So you're drinking Yingling. So you're switching it up. You're cheating on us.
I am, but only because I don't have any wine here.
Oh, so. You finished it all?
I did. And look at my little koozie.
Aw, dog kisses and beer fix everything.
It's true. Aw.
I'm drinking pretty much Fresca with a tiny bit of Franzia boxed red wine.
Honestly, boxed wine, you could never go wrong with a boxed wine.
It was all I had.
That's fine. Hey, I'm drinking beer.
True.
We're really Franzia slacking.
And Fresca, I know. But it was a snow day. I wasn't going out and buying any wine.
Beer, boxed wine, crime, and TV time.
Literally. Okay. So, like I said earlier, we're going to be talking about a case that kind of has three victims in it, and it's going to center around one person. And what's really eerie about it is this person seems to be the last person to see each of these people alive, which I find creepy. So, first I want to start with the first victim. Her name is Betsy Faria, I think is how you say her last name. And Betsy was born on March 24th, 1969, and I couldn't find much information about her childhood, so I assumed it was pretty normal, because, like I said, I couldn't find anything about it. She was described as unique, the life of the party, kind, could light up a room with her smile, a great time. I feel like, and I'm not trying to be, like, insensitive here, but I feel like this is the description of every victim.
I was just thinking that. I was thinking that it was the description of Angela Hammond.
And also, like, Lacey Peterson. I don't know if you remember that, but that's what they always said about her.
Yes.
But, yeah, I feel like that's how everybody does, which, I mean, I get it. Like, what are you going to say? Like, she was a fucking bitch.
Hated her.
Yeah. So, Betsy lived in Troy, Missouri with her husband, Russ, and she had had two daughters from a previous marriage that did not live with them. And our case begins in 2011, and at this point in time, Russ and Betsy had been married for 12 years, and most people describe their marriage as great. Her mother claimed that Russ was a devoted son-in-law and was accepted into the family right away. Betsy was...
Really quick, what does a devoted son-in-law mean?
Right. I feel like it means, like, she probably could call him and he would just show up and do whatever.
So right? Devoted. Okay. I mean, yeah, that makes sense. I hope.
But Betsy was 42 and had been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer a few years earlier.
What kind of cancer?
I think it was breast cancer. It was breast cancer.
Okay.
She was diagnosed with breast cancer, and it was a few years ago. And it seemed like she was kind of on and off. Like, she would go into remission, and then it would come back, and go into remission, and it would come back. So on December 27th, 2011, Betsy had underwent a chemotherapy treatment, and she was picked up by her mom's friend, Bobby. And I couldn't tell, and Bobby's a woman, and the two went out to dinner, but I couldn't tell if Bobby lived with her mother or not. It kind of seemed like she did, but, I mean, whatever.
Yeah.
So Bobby dropped Betsy off at her mother's for a few hours before Betsy's friend Pam came over. And I guess the four of them, like, wound up playing games together and whatever. And her friend Pam was somebody that she had met working at State Farm together. They both had worked there. I don't think Betsy was working anymore. But that's how they knew each other and they stayed friends. And she came over, they played games, and she brought her home around 7. They left there at, like, 6:30. And around 9:40, Russ Feria makes a phone call to 911 claiming that he had just gotten home and found his wife had committed suicide on the floor of their living room. So I want to play that 911 call real quick.
That's so sad.
So sad.
Lincoln County 911, what is the location of your emergency? Okay, ma'am. Hello? Yes, I need you to take a couple deep breaths so I can see what's going on. What is the address where you need this to come?
130 CMAX.
Okay, what is the telephone number you're calling from in case we get disconnected?
I don't know this number. I know my cell phone number.
Okay, what is that number?
It's 04-565-9207.
I'm sorry, repeat the last four.
9207.
Okay, who am I speaking with?
My name is Russell Faria.
Russell, what's going on there?
I just got home from a friend's house, and my wife killed herself. She's on the floor.
Okay, Russell, I need you to calm down, honey, okay? I need you to calm down, take a couple deep breaths. We're going to get somebody on the way there, okay? What did she do? Do you know?
She got a knife in her neck and she fed her arms.
Okay, calm down, honey. Is she breathing at all?
No.
She is not breathing?
No, I didn't want to breathe.
Okay. Russell, is there anybody that we can call for you? Okay, Russell, take a couple deep breaths on, okay?
I don't, I obviously don't want to play the whole thing, but... Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, it's just horrible.
Like, literally horrible, horrifying.
Like, I'm thinking, also, I'm just comparing to our other friend who called the cops... And I just feel like hers is just so much more fake compared to that. Do you know what
Darlene?
I mean? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's what we think. That's what we think, anyway.
Uh-huh.
Because I will say, on the first part of that, I was like, oh, this sounds so phony. Like,
oh, that is so not phony, though.
But then you start hearing him, like, literally, like, sobbing from his stomach. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I felt that.
Yeah. Super Ugh. Sad.
Yeah.
So when first responders arrived, they noticed that Betsy was lying on the floor in the middle of the living room. They had noticed that there was coagulated blood on her, and they found a knife protruding from the left side of her neck. And they also found another knife in between the couch cushions underneath a pillow. And that's something that I definitely want you to keep in mind for later, because this is going to come back around. Mm-hmm. But they had noticed that the handles on the knives had matched knives that they found in the kitchen, and they found what looked like a dog print on her, like, left, like, butt. And they also had noticed that rigor mortis and livor mortis were evident. Mm. They noticed that the master bedroom, like, when they went in there, that the switch plate, when you walk in, had, like, blood smeared on it. They also came across a pair of tan men's slippers with what appeared to be bloodstains on the sides of them in the master closet. They also noticed that the dog was tied up outside at this point.
Poor puppy.
I know. And their dog, I just want to make a note, was half, this doesn't necessarily mean anything, mm-hmm. but was half golden retriever and half chow chow.
Oh, big puppy.
But just to keep in mind for what they try to say later. But I mean, I could be wrong. But anyway. So, on December 28th, the medical examiner did an autopsy of the victim, and her cause of death was determined to be homicide. Not suicide. Mm-hmm. So it was determined that she had been stabbed a total of 55 times.
Yeah, that's almost suicide.
Right. And that's what they literally said to him. They were like, yeah, so, you know, I think that it's really impossible that your wife committed suicide because she was stabbed 55 times.
Mm-hmm.
So the medical examiner could not determine what the fatal wound was, but her death was obviously caused by a combination of all of her stab wounds. There were, however, stab wounds that were inflicted after her death, and they could tell that due to, like, the lack of blood that was found at the scene from 55 stab wounds. Like, you would imagine that the scene is covered in blood, but if somebody, like, if you stab somebody and they die,
yeah,
then they're not going to continue to, like, you know what I'm saying? They're not going to continue to bleed, therefore, right. Like, the blood's going to start kind of to dry.
Right.
The medical examiner also could not determine an exact time of death due to the nature of her injuries. However, keep in mind that at 9:40 or 9:47, I think it was, when first responders got there, rigor mortis and livor mortis had begun to set in, and that means that she would have had to have been dead for at least 2 hours at that point. Just for anybody who doesn't really know much about rigor or livor mortis,
mm-hmm.
rigor mortis is what happens to a body after it's been dead for like 2 to 6 hours, and it's the stiffening of joints and muscles. So like what I always think of is like when you see a dead deer on the side of the road mm-hmm. and their like arms are like literally straight out, like that's from rigor mortis.
Right.
Dave actually says it all the time. He's like, oh, the rigor mortis is set in whenever we drive past.
All right.
And livor mortis usually occurs within 2 to 4 hours as well, but it actually presents the signs present themselves after rigor mortis. It's the fourth stage in rigor mortis from like what I've read. And that's basically where like the blood rushes to in the body as it sits. So like in this case, she was laying on her like right side, mm-hmm. therefore like her right abdomen, livor mortis was like able to be detected because it turns like a bluish purplish color from the right. blood all rushing to that one spot. And that would kind of help determine how long the body had been there, because if she were moved at any point in time, that wouldn't be there. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So like I said, she had to be in that position for at least 2 hours. On December 27th, when first responders arrived a little after 9:40 to the home of Russ and Betsy Feria, they had believed that they were walking in to investigate a suicide. When Deputy Hollingsworth arrived, Betsy had slashes all along her wrists, as well as that black-handled knife protruding out of her neck, which is so crazy to me.
Yeah.
And he stated that Russ was very visibly upset, but he didn't notice anything coming out of his eyes, like many tears. He also stated that Russ was in a state of panic, and he was having a really hard time talking or breathing when he was explaining that his wife committed suicide. Eventually, he gave him a ride to the police station. He went to go, like, help out, as people do without lawyers. And
so dumb.
In the car, he explained that Betsy had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and she had had her breasts removed 2 years ago. And he told him that it was stage 4. She was still on many medications. She was still receiving chemotherapy. And that's actually where she was earlier that day. And he did tell him that she had attempted suicide a few times prior to this. Russ told police that he works from home, but he left around 5:00 in the afternoon and called Betsy around 5:30. She was staying at her mom's the night before her chemotherapy treatment. I don't know if it was like closer for her by her mom's house or anything. It just said that she was staying there. And he called her to see if she wanted him to pick her up that night after his game night, since his mother lived like within minutes of the friend.
Mm-hmm.
And Betsy explained to him that her friend Pam was going to bring her home after they had finished playing their game at their mother's house. And he said that Betsy had something to tell him when she got home, but wouldn't say over the phone. She just said that it was something good. Russ says he went to go pick up dog food on his way to his friend Mike Corbin's house. And he went to his friend's house every Tuesday. They played this, like, one game. It was kind of weird. It seemed like a role-play game.
Oh.
It was a little weird. But, yeah, that's what he did on Tuesdays. So I guess she also didn't like being home by herself on Tuesdays, so she would go, like, stay with her mom. And when the deputy asked Russ what time he left Mike's house, Russ said that he left around 9:00 before stopping at Arby's to pick up dinner and the UGAS gas station to buy a pack of cigarettes on his way home. there is surveillance video of him stopping at this gas station to get the cigarettes. So it kind of corroborates the right time. Mm-hmm. He claims that he got home around 9:45, put the dog food down when he got in, and that's when he saw Betsy. He, like, pretty much walked in and saw her. Mm. And he claimed that he fell to the ground next to her for a few minutes before calling 911. Russ said he also noticed that their dog was outside at this point, which he thought was strange because usually the dog would stay inside and would not be tied up for, like, long periods of time outside. Also, keep in mind that it is December. It's right after Christmas, so it's, like, pretty cold to, like, leave a golden retriever outside.
Right,
you know?
Right.
It's not like a husky that loves the snow. It's, mm-hmm. like, they don't live like that. So, the detectives also stated that the dog was outside barking as a dog would at strangers when they arrived. Russ stated that before he left the house that afternoon for his game night, he made sure all the doors were locked, and investigators found no signs of forced entry. Later that day, police interviewed the family friend Bobby Wan, which is the one, which is such a weird name. Also.
Bobby Wan.
this was the friend who brought Betsy to chemotherapy and, like, picked her up, and they went out to dinner that night. And she said Betsy was in really good spirits that day. She also confirmed that Betsy's friend Pam Hupp came to Betsy's mother's house and took Betsy home around 6:30. She said that Pam called Janet, which is Betsy's mother. She called Janet around 8:45 to tell her that she tried to get a hold of Betsy but couldn't, which I find a little weird because, like, I don't know. If I couldn't get a hold of you, I wouldn't immediately call your mom.
I fucking hope not.
But, I mean, to each their own. So she said Betsy told her, this is what the friend Bobby said. Mm-hmm. Betsy told her that she wanted to move out of her and Russ's home, and they wanted to get a home for her, Russ, her sister, and her mother, because her sister's home was going to foreclosure.
Oh, wow.
And they wanted to rent out the home that Betsy and Russ owned for, like, extra money.
Okay.
And that's what she was going to tell Russ that night. So that was kind of the news, I guess. So after talking to Russ more later, it had come out that he and Betsy actually had briefly separated in 2008, but they got back together shortly after. I don't think that this lasted very long. He said that Betsy briefly dated somebody for a little bit, but...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But yeah, they had gotten back together. And at this point in the questioning, his story starts to change a little bit. Now he starts to claim that he may have left the front door unlocked on his way out, which wouldn't have been out of character for him. He also changes the order of when he went to go get his cigarettes and where. He kind of says that he, like, actually went before he went to the friend's house, and it was a different gas station.
But you said there's surveillance, right?
Exactly, yeah. So that's what I was just going to say, too, is, like, that doesn't really mean anything to me.
Yeah. Like,
that he's changing his story because there's surveillance of when that happened.
Oh, yeah.
That being said, I don't know that they had the surveillance footage at this point in the interrogation.
Mm.
So that could be why that seemed like an important piece, but I don't know. Also, when they were talking to the 911 operator, she notes that she could tell that the sound and the background of the call was changing, kind of like insinuating that Russ had been moving throughout different rooms in the house, which, if you remember, that's like something that we saw... with Darcy. Darcy. Right. Now I'm calling her Darcy because you called her Darcy
Sorry.
Once.
Sorry.
you could tell she was, like, moving around and stuff. But I didn't pick up on that. I wasn't listening for it, but I didn't pick up on it.
I mean, we also were not trained to, like, listen for things like that.
Right.
But also, like, I'm thinking, like, if I'm, like, frantic,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to be pacing. I already pace when I'm on the phone in general, so...
Right, and... I mean, I would imagine that if, like I was saying, rigor mortis was set in, her body must have been cold, and it must have been really, like, scary to be there with her. Like, you know she's dead. You, like, don't really want to look at this. You're kind of panicked.
Right.
Maybe. I don't know.
I wouldn't want to be, like, hanging out with her body.
No. Same. she also says that when she told Russ to check and see if Betsy was breathing, he said she was dead, which we heard that whole entire, like, little portion mm-hmm. where she's like, is she breathing? And he, like, just loses it there, you know? It's not like she's like, check and see if she's breathing. And he's like, no, she's dead. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know, but a little weird. I can understand why that's weird. They had also spoken about Betsy's life insurance policies, and Russ claimed that she had had about $400,000 to $500,000 in different life insurance policies. He was the main beneficiary of most of them. Mm-hmm. I think that her sister was, like, the successor below him for most of them, but they talk about that a little bit, but then one that really, really stood out was one that was through State Farm. Mm-hmm. So there was about a $150,000 life insurance policy through State Farm, which was Betsy's old employer. Mm-hmm. And the primary beneficiary was listed as Russ Faria. How do you say that? Faria?
Faria?
Faria. I keep saying it wrong. Russ Faria. With the successor beneficiary being her sister, Mary Rogers. And then the final beneficiary was Russ's aunt, which I thought was kind of weird, but Deborah Shomsky.
Mm.
So this was the case all up until December 23rd, 2011, which was 4 days before Betsy's murder, when Pamela Hupp was now named the sole beneficiary of that life insurance policy. So I don't know if everybody remembers who Pamela Hupp is, but Pamela Hupp is the friend who was driving Betsy home that night. So was the last person to see Betsy alive, pretty much.
Right.
So Betsy's signature was on this, and it was witnessed by the librarian. I guess they like went to, I don't know this is how it worked, but they signed the paperwork at this library. And this
maybe,
woman
maybe
had to
she
witness
was a notary.
It. Oh, notaries work at libraries? I like don't understand how these things work.
Some places have like weird notary people, yeah.
Oh. Well, that must be the case, because she, like, maybe witnessed this all. So it's not like it was a mistake.
Hmm.
So after discussing life insurance policies, they took fingerprints, they swabbed Russ for DNA, and he was placed under arrest. At this point, they asked what Russ was wearing when he had worked from home that day, and he said that he kind of described, and he said that he did wear his slippers that day. Russ claimed he never went into the bedroom once he found Betsy, and he doesn't understand how his slippers wound up in there or how they had blood on him, mm-hmm, or on them. There also were no bloody footprints and no blood on the soles of the slippers, just like some spots on the side. There was a baseball cap that Russ had been seen in the surveillance video that was laying on the floor in the kitchen with a drop of his blood on it. And also the only DNA that was found inside the slipper was Russ's. All other DNA evidence, though, at the scene did not match his. It was pretty much all just Betsy's.
Mm.
He consented to a lie detector test, and deception was indicated. And I'm not really sure what questions it was, like, indicated on, but it says that he failed the lie detector test.
What?
Yeah. So things aren't looking so hot for him.
No, and I... Okay.
So, at this point, investigators decide to interview Pam Hupp, Betsy's friend who drove her home, who was also the beneficiary of her one life insurance policy, which is so bizarre to me. So Pam says that she went to Betsy's mother's to pick up Betsy to bring her home after they all played games. Mm-hmm. She found it odd that Russ was going to go pick her up and bring her home, considering she had always stayed at her mother's on Tuesdays while Russ went to his game nights. Pam does not remember what time they had gotten back to Betsy's house. But she knew that she had called her husband to let her know, or to let him know that they had gotten there, since she doesn't drive very well at night. And she noticed that the Nissan that Russ usually drives was in the driveway, and the lights were off in the house. She claims that Russ said he would leave the door unlocked for Betsy, which Pam remembers not liking, because she just didn't want Betsy going home to an unlocked open house.
Right.
But Betsy didn't have her purse on her.
Oh.
Yeah, so from what I gather from that is I assume it would have meant that she had no way of getting in.
Okay.
Which, I have an issue with this whole purse thing, because if we remember, she had gone to a chemotherapy appointment that day, and I feel like you probably have a copay, you mm-hmm probably need to show your ID, you probably need to, like, sign in.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, wouldn't you need your purse for that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, for sure.
I find that weird that, like, was her purse just, like, she forgot it at home? I don't know. But Pam said this was odd because Betsy lived out of her purse. Like, she always had her purse on her. When Pam asked Betsy why she didn't have her purse, she claims that Russ told her to leave it home. Which is weird.
So weird.
She also asked if Russ could be driving another car, like their other car that they had had, instead of the Nissan. And Betsy said no, because he had told her that he was driving the Nissan. She claims that she walked Betsy to the door and helped her turn on the lights, and they went inside and called Pam's husband again. And she told her husband that she was leaving. At this moment in time, she said she was leaving. Betsy let the dog out on the back patio, and Pam claimed that the dog was really aggressive and that the dog scared Betsy. That's why she, like, let it out on the patio. Okay. But mind you, this is a golden chow chow mix.
Right.
And maybe it could be aggressive, but... And also, this is her dog.
Right.
So...
So weird.
I don't know about all that.
Yeah.
She says she stayed for another 10 to 20 minutes, which she had just told her husband that she was leaving, so that's a little weird to me. However, I mean, there are definitely times where I'm like, oh yeah, I'm leaving, and I leave an hour later.
That's what I do all the time.
So maybe it's not that weird. She claims that Betsy showed her the Christmas gift that Russ had gotten her, and it was a jewelry chest. And she said that she thought Betsy was upset because she thought it was used, and because it had a broken leg, which Betsy had said that Russ told her that he broke the leg sliding it into the master bedroom, and that's how the leg broke. And she claims that she had left even though Betsy had wanted her to stay and watch movies with her, but Russ would be home soon. And I find this weird because she was so concerned about him leaving the door unlocked, about his car being in the driveway, the lights being off, her not having her purse, all these things. Why would you leave your friend alone and not just wait like the couple of minutes or whatever, or I guess at this point it was going to be a couple of hours.
Right.
Why wouldn't you just wait for her husband to get home?
I mean, I would.
Yeah, like, why wouldn't you watch movies with her? Why did you leave?
I mean, we just spent 5 hours watching TV together the other day for no reason. So. True.
Like, I just find that a little...
It is strange.
Weird?
Yeah.
Pam also alleged that Betsy was scared of Russ, that he was demeaning, he was angry, he made all of Betsy's friends uncomfortable, and she talks about incidents where Russ would hold a pillow over Betsy's face, claiming this is what it would feel like to die.
Imagine doing that to someone.
Right. Really so weird.
Strange.
And Betsy would claim that he seemed like he was kidding after the fact, but it was just, like, really strange. She also claims that Russ would get extremely angry with Betsy over her wetting the bed due to her illness, and he wanted her to wear adult diapers to bed. They discuss the insurance policy and Pam now being the beneficiary, and she claims that Betsy did not want Russ to have control of the money, and that she couldn't name her daughter's beneficiaries because they would blow through the money. And actually, a little bit about her daughters. They didn't live with them. One lived with the grandmother and one lived with the aunt, because the one kept, like, stealing from Betsy and Russ, and then she kept stealing from the grandmother, and now she lives with the aunt.
How old are these children?
I want to say they were in their 20s at this point.
Okay.
But I'm not 100% positive on that.
Okay.
But, yeah, that was... I just wanted to put that out there, which makes sense that she didn't want her kids to have that money right away.
Oh, yeah.
She says that she originally was against the idea, this is Pam, but she eventually agreed to it to help Betsy. She claims that she feared Russ finding out by hacking Betsy's computer. Pam also remembered a scenario on December 23rd where Betsy had asked Russ to get her some Gatorade at the store when they were going to do a workout. And Betsy took a sip of it, like a big gulp of it, and she couldn't tolerate the taste. She like literally like gagged and spit it out or something. And Pam says that the Gatorade was extremely cloudy. She said that she thought Betsy should return the Gatorades, but Betsy never did. And just a little note, these Gatorade bottles were never found at the house, in the car, anywhere. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
The Gatorades that she claimed existed. So I think what Pam is trying to insinuate there is that he was trying to, like, poison her or something, is kind of what I got.
But yeah, that's what I'm gathering from that as well.
So they take photos, they do swabs of DNA, and she gives over her alleged clothes that she wore the night of Betsy's murder, and they ask her to do a polygraph test. Pam's physician denied her medical release to take the polygraph. She said
you can do that?
Couldn't, I guess. I didn't know that until this.
That's crazy.
Super weird. They interview Pam's husband, and the story seemed to add up. Pam and Betsy called him, and Betsy wished him a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and Pam said she was leaving, and that's kind of, like, where it was left at. I will say that Pam claimed that she called Betsy again. I can't remember what time I saw it, but she had called her later, and she claimed that she was calling her because she was letting her know that she was home, and this is when Betsy didn't answer. And I believe that she said that this was around 7:30 or something like that, maybe even, like, a little bit earlier, but they also made it a point to say, like, well, it would have been impossible that she would have been home at 7:30 considering the drive from Betsy's mom's at 6:30, then going to Betsy's, hanging out for 10 to 20 minutes at least.
Right.
And then going home.
Right.
So, and then she changed her story and said that, oh, no, I was almost home.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Likely story.
Yeah. So, when they interviewed Russ's friends from the game night that evening, they all had pretty much the same story. They said that he was at Mike Corbin's house, they played some of their game, and they watched the movie The Road, but the movie was boring, so they stopped it halfway, and they all pretty much claimed that Russ left around 8:45 to 9 o'clock, and everyone else left pretty much immediately after. There was also a receipt from the Arby's restaurant placing Russ there. However, the timing was off. This is so frustrating. The timing was off by the time that, like, by the notes that dispatch said, I guess, that he had stated, and the Arby's restaurant by 3 minutes.
So, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, so the evidence was considered invalid and destroyed.
That's kind of bullshit. I mean, you're not going to know exactly what time you're doing all these things.
I found that really weird that 3 minutes were a make or break.
It shouldn't be, if it was, like, 3 hours.
Yeah. So, like, why are you... Why... What?
I'm confused.
That, I thought, was a little bit, like, almost like you're picking and choosing evidence, you know?
Right.
There were also text conversations stating that Russ was, in fact, going to Mike's that night, and him saying that he'll pick up Betsy. These were texts between them. However, a few hours later, after he had said, and he was like, oh, I'm going to game night. I shouldn't be too late. I'll pick you up after. And she's like, okay, honey, like, whatever. Right. Like, everything's cool.
Right.
And a few hours later, he gets a text from Betsy saying that Pam insisted on driving her home and that he didn't have to come get her. And he kind of questions this a little bit. And he's like, oh, she's bringing you back to, like, to our house? And she's like, yeah, she insisted. And I just accepted because... whatever, I don't know. But that's also a little bit strange, is, like, so Pam lived about 45 minutes from Betsy's mother. And she also lived 30 minutes from Betsy.
Oh, wow.
Right. So why are you,
like, going in a different direction?
Yeah, why would you go all the way out of your way to go? And I get, like, it's your friend, but she was fine. Like, her husband was going to come get her, or somebody was going to come. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the fact that she insisted on it is a little, like, fishy. The prosecution also obtained Betsy's laptop from her friend Pam Hupp, containing a note seemingly written from Betsy to Pam. But she never sent.
They got the laptop from Pam?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Pam's the one who came in with it.
Mm-hmm. Of course she did.
And she came across this note that Betsy had written to her, but never sent to her. And I don't want to get too ahead of myself, but eventually when they looked into this note, it was determined that it actually would have been almost impossible for it to have been written on that computer. It looked as though it had been written somewhere else and then sent to that computer and then saved on that computer,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to read the letter, but I can't find it anywhere. I've, like, searched all over the place to, like, bring up this letter to read it. But it's basically, like, saying that she's afraid of Russ. And if anything happens to her, that it was Russ. And I think it goes on to talk about, like, her, like, Pam protecting her money and making sure her kids get it in the end. And put it in a trust for them and stuff. And I don't really know. I tried to find it, but I can't find it. So
right.
We're just going to move on.
I forgive you.
I'm so sorry. I worked hard. So Russ's trial began on November 18th, 2013, and the prosecution presented all of the evidence that they had against him, and the defense brought up his friends who were pretty much his alibi to testify, and they brought up, like, the proof of everywhere he went that night. They brought up the fact that he had no blood on his clothes or himself. The prosecutor cross-examined these friends, claiming they were giving Russ a false alibi.
What?
Yeah, and that was what her claim was. There was no evidence supporting that claim. She just accused them of all giving a false alibi.
Okay, honey.
So Russ's lawyer, Joel Schwartz, it's like a mouthful.
Yeah.
Claimed to have evidence against another suspect. However, the judge would not allow this to be presented as evidence in the case because it was seen as irrelevant because that person's not on trial and he is on trial. So your job is to just prove that he didn't do it, not give me who did do it. So
right.
I get that, but that would give a lot of evidence to prove that he didn't do it. So after just a 3-day trial on November 21st, Russ was found guilty of first-degree murder, and on December 22nd, 2013, he was sentenced to life plus 30 years in prison. I also want to make a note on the fact that Russ's friends, who allegedly created this false alibi and helped him carry out the murder, saw no charges or punishment or anything, even though that was the prosecution's, like, strongest point, was the fact that they made this up. So shouldn't they be charged with,
yeah,
right? Like, they should be charged with an accomplice to murder or whatever.
Fuck this. He did not fucking do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he was found guilty. And that was, what, 2013?
We're done. End the podcast.
I'm done. Oh, but it gets so much more intense.
I know. So but much I'm more happened. Definitely mad.
So what's so crazy is, like, there are so many cases that, like, are just, like, wrongful convictions, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is, like, sad. But on a slightly more positive note, in February of 2015, so a little less than 2 years later, Schwartz appealed Russ's conviction, seeking a new trial due to new evidence and the fact that the judge, the original judge, had recused herself from this case. And Russ was actually released on bond pending a new trial, so he got a new trial.
Okay.
It also turned out that the prosecutor on this case, Leah Askey, was in a relationship with the captain of investigations and was one of the main investigators in the Betsy Faria case and also testified against Russ in the case.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, you know, that kind of came out and it was like, well, that's definitely a
conflict of interest.
Yeah, a total conflict of interest. Yeah. So there was also an interview with the 911 operator that had come out at this point, who claimed that Russ's reactions actually seemed really, really genuine.
Yeah.
She said that he sounded like somebody who really had lost somebody.
I, like, felt the pain.
Yeah.
Like, that fucking, like, sobbing pain.
So sad. I definitely agree. And, like, I find that interesting because they used her earlier in saying how he sounded like he was moving around and stuff like that and whatever. So also, around this time, the $150,000 life insurance policy that Pam Hupp was supposed to keep in a trust for the girls was pulled from that trust.
Wow, shocker.
At the end of this trial. So during Russ's entire trial, she had that money kept in a trust. And then right after the trial, she pulled it and kept the money for herself. And due to all of that, jurors on that trial felt like there were so many red flags and there was so much information that was withheld and they would probably have had a different outcome had they known these things.
Mm-hmm.
So during the retrial, Russ decided to not have a jury. They went forward without a jury and they just had a judge decide his fate pretty much.
That's rough.
It can be, but it can be a good idea. Because a jury of your peers can, like, see the crime and, like, really want justice for the victim, no matter who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, a judge sees this every day. This is their job. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I get what you're saying.
Evidence may be more clear to a judge than a jury. I assume that his lawyer recommended this.
Right.
So during the retrial, Schwartz was able to present evidence he had against Pam Hupp to the judge. Whereas in the last trial, he couldn't do that. A CSI agent who examined the crime scene claimed that Russ's slippers never stepped in blood. The sides were just kind of dipped in blood a little bit. They also had officers testify that Pam Hupp claimed that she was having a sexual and emotional relationship with Betsy. This was all of a sudden she was saying Jesus. This. Yeah. And nobody believed it. Like, her family didn't believe it. Nobody believed it. And she had also just now remembered, 4 years later, whatever it is, that she had actually seen a man parked outside when she drove Betsy home. If that's the case, then why did you leave her?
Right.
Right? So she just kind of, like, changed her story all the time. Like, she would sometimes say that she went in with Betsy after dropping her off. Sometimes she said she didn't. It was just kind of, like, back and forth and all over the case. And the defense also brought up that librarian who witnessed Betsy's signature on switching the life insurance policy.
Okay.
And she claimed that it seemed that Pam was actually the one in charge and kind of bossing Betsy around. And it didn't seem like Betsy was the one that was, like, leading this whole thing. She remembers, like, asking her. I remember reading that she said, like, I remember asking her, like, if she was sure that this is what she wanted. Like, if she was like, whatever. And she just definitely seemed unsure but, like, scared.
Right.
They brought up the fact that Betsy didn't need Pam to drive her home that night as she had Russ picking her up, but Pam insisted. They spoke about how Russ had an alibi and Pam actually put herself right at the scene of the crime during the time that they believe Betsy was killed. She also placed herself in the bedroom where they found blood evidence of Betsy's, whereas Russ says he never even went into the bedroom. But if you remember, she said that, oh, Betsy showed me the jewelry chest or whatever, which is the room that they found the slippers and that blood on the switch plate. Mm-hmm. Pam was also the last person to see Betsy alive. So finally, on November 7th, 2015, Russ's conviction was overturned. And in January of 2017, the original judge on the case was suspended from his job for misconduct.
Fucking good.
Yeah, and that was connected to the Betsy Faria case. And in August of 2018, both the judge and the prosecutor were voted out of office, mostly due to the mishandling of cases. I think mostly probably due to the mishandling of this case. So investigators never looked into Pam Hupp as a prime suspect in this case. I'm not sure if they just felt that they didn't have enough evidence or concrete evidence or what, but they never named her, like, officially as a suspect.
Are they fucking dumb?
I don't know if this is, like, I don't know if this is, like, something that they're, like, trying to keep close to their chest or their vest. I mean, their chest. Close to their vest to, like, have a smoking gun that, like, really proves it. Because this is all circumstantial if you really think about it. It's all just bizarre, strange behavior.
Yeah.
We have no DNA evidence connecting her there. We have nothing, honestly, if you think about it.
Getting a migraine.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. But also in that civil case, did I talk about the civil case with her daughters?
No.
So, Betsy's two daughters had filed a civil case basically over the fact that Pam had pulled that money out of that trust for them, even though it was an agreement. Mm-hmm. However, Pam won that case.
So what? She
didn't give them a dime. Because, in June of 2016, they had gone to trial, and a judge had determined that the fact that all of the paperwork was correct, all of the I's were dotted, all the T's were crossed, like, the girls really had no leg to stand on. And even her lawyer was like, listen, I don't think she's a credible witness at all. I don't believe anything that comes out of her mouth.
You're right.
But at the end of the day, you got to look at the paperwork, and the paperwork says that she's in charge. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Bullshit, it was just a big, gigantic mistake. And this woman, it seemed like, kept getting off and getting off and getting off.
Fucking
kid. And it was like, is she going to get away with everything? So when she was leaving the court after this case, she smiles at the Dateline cameras and says, "Tell Kathy I said hi," who is one of the Dateline, one of their producers.
Okay.
Which may seem like really unimportant, but it's going to come back. And it kind of seemed like there'd be like no closure. Like I was just saying, like, it just seemed like she was just going to keep getting away with shit, but like everybody would be able to move on and like put it behind them. You know, at least Russ got out of jail for something he didn't do. Daughters never talked to him again after that. I don't know what their relationship was like, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But they never talked to him. And prior to all this coming out, the mother said, like, you can show me whatever evidence you want, but I believe that Russ did it.
Oh, God. Okay.
But this is before that they really knew. That was, like, the first Dateline episode.
Okay.
Before they really knew what was going on with Pam. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I don't know if that changed. But who knows? So on August 16th, 2016, less than a year after Russ's conviction was overturned and 2 months after the civil suit with Betsy's daughters was over, officers in O'Fallon, Missouri received a call, a 911 call, from none other than Pam Hupp.
Oh, no fucking way.
And she had claimed that someone had broken into her car and followed her into her home. And she's asking the officers for help. So I'm going to play this 911 call because just you wait.
Okay.
It's actually very sad, but it's something.
911, where's your emergency? Hey, hello, there's someone breaking in my house. Help.
What's the address you're at?
No, I'm not getting in the car with you. No,
what's your address?
Get out, get out, get out. Everything's open. I was leaving out of my car.
know when they're closed.
Okay.
You are not injured, though.
No.
What's your name?
My name is Pam.
Pam?
Yes. Where are they?
Is anybody in the home with you besides the subject who broke in?
No, just my dog.
Just you and your dog?
Me.
I got my dog with me. Help, please, where
Pam,
are they?
We have help on the way. Let me know when you hear them.
Okay.
I should have an officer pulling up. Do you see him?
It's an un-white car. I don't know. It's just a white car.
It's going to be one of our command staff. Is he in a uniform?
He's here. He's here.
Okay, I'm going to let you go. Talk to the officer.
Did she actually really think that she was convincing?
Oh, she thinks she's smarter than everybody, just Hello. As everybody does.
Hello, help. Hello.
Hello, help. Somebody's breaking into my house. Help.
Oh, no. But
the reason that I can tell that she is a big, giant liar is the fact that you shot this guy. You left your gun on your bed with somebody you just shot and left your house.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
and also she, like, neglects to bring up the fact that she shot him until, like, 20 minutes into the phone conversation.
Right.
She's like, ha, like, yeah, shot him. Like,
well,
what?
You hear the shots.
Yep.
You hear the shots in
but
the...
But why didn't the dispatcher be like,
She's probably like, oh, it's probably just, like, wrestling around. Also, I want to make a note of the fact that when she's on the phone... Some people don't know this, but when you pick up the phone to call 911, the second that you hit, like, dial, it starts recording. And she doesn't start her, like, little panic spiel until they pick up. Mm-hmm. So wouldn't you, if somebody, like, broke in and you were, like, wrestling around, like, that would be happening while you're on the phone and...
Right.
And whatever.
Right. You would think.
Exactly.
She's not smart.
She thinks she is, though. That's, like... That's the thing. She thinks she's smart. She's trying to distract any information about her and play the victim. And make somebody right. else be the guy who did this. So, she claims that this guy broke into her car and threatened her with a knife and said that they were going to the bank to get Russ's money. She claims that they struggled and the knife dropped and then she, like, ran out of the car into her house through the garage to get her gun from her nightstand and had to shoot him in self-defense, which you hear.
Bang, bang, bang.
Yeah. Help, someone broke in, help.
Oh,
help.
God, I
help.
Shot them.
Help. Help. When police arrived, they had found a man in between the doorway of, like, the hallway and the garage door, like, that would lead into the garage, mm-hmm. next to her master bedroom. He had no ID on him. He only had a note in his pocket, and it explained how much money to get, how to get it, and to kill Pam and to leave the knife in her neck. And they also found $900 in cash in his pocket. Mm. She also claims that she got a brief look at the man who was driving her supposed attacker. Because, mind you, oh, this guy didn't drive a car there and park there and come in. He came to burglarize her house without his own car.
Right.
And not her house, but, like, her.
Also, I don't know why it just makes me think of No Scrubs. Hanging out to best friend's ride.
Literally, though, but, like, you're gonna go... What? Without right. without a getaway car? So she claims that she got a decent look at the guy, and pretty much the description she gave was Russ. Like... That's what she described the guy to look like. Mm-hmm. So at this point, investigators call Russ down to the station and explain that Pam has implicated him in this and that he was involved. And they take handwriting samples from this note because it was handwritten. Mm-hmm. They take DNA, they take fingerprints, and Russ was ruled out as a suspect. Detective Larry McLean gives a listen to the 911 call, and he just felt that it didn't sound right, which...
Shocker. Right.
And this is kind of what I was saying before, how he noticed that, like, the dispatch, like, before the dispatcher picks up, there's no, like, there's nothing going on. She's not running around. There's no tension in her voice.
She's and chilling.
Even when she's describing the thing, there's not really real panic or tension. It's like, she just keeps saying, help, help,
help.
Which, if you're out help. Of your house, help. And why did you leave your doors all open?
Yeah.
And your gun.
And I would have your dog taken my gun and taken my dog and peace the fuck out.
And run.
Yeah. I wouldn't like, stay run. In my garage.
Yeah. So, oh, and also notice, I forgot to say this, you don't hear any tension in the man's voice.
No, because she made it up. I feel like she's the one that, like, you know, she disguised her voice to say that.
Well, just you wait.
No, I'm wrong. Okay.
Oh, you're wrong. But you hear no tension in his voice.
I literally, the first thing I saw, even though just I wait, but the first thing I thought of was, it sounds like she pulled the phone away from her and is like, ba 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 ba.
Yeah, you know? Kind of. Yeah, like you don't hear, he just sounds like he's like doing bad acting.
Mm-hmm.
So, detectives noticed that this knife that was allegedly knocked out during the struggle in her car, they noticed that it was placed with the blade directly down, and it was in between the center console and the passenger seat, like, directly down the blade in between. They also noticed that her knives in the kitchen were stored the same way, with the blade down in between the counter and the stove.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you remember this, but do you remember when they found that second knife in between the two couch cushions at Betsy's house?
Mm-hmm.
And the knife was face down, the blade was face down in between the cushions.
Right.
So that's a little, like, interesting to me.
Strange.
Also, Betsy was left with the knife protruding from her neck, and the instructions on this note stated the same thing to do the same thing with Pam.
Mm-hmm.
Which... I think that personally, she thought that she was being smart by being like, oh, well, how would anybody know about this unless they were there? And like,
right.
You know?
Right.
So they dusted the knife for prints, and the only prints that they found on this knife were on the blade, almost as if somebody had pinched the blade in between their fingers. Like, that's all that was on there.
They probably fucking did.
Like this, yeah. Well, and who knows? Who knows if she ran out to the car, grabbed this knife, and put his fingerprints on it after shooting him and whatever.
Right.
But they found no prints on the handle or anything. It was also noted that Pam had bought a knife exactly like that one at the Dollar Tree that day.
The Dollar Tree.
Yeah.
That's where I buy all my knives.
Right? So underneath this man's dead body was a small piece of like extra carpet, almost like if you get new carpet in your house and there's leftover, you like keep it in the garage or something like that, or like maybe you'll make a pathway like by your foyer so that people don't get it dirty. It was placed right on top of the carpet, like this carpet was placed on top of the carpet where his head laid, almost to like not get the carpet dirty.
She's really like weird. Planning the body. Like, laying there.
Yeah. Like, oh, you know what? Let me be a little considerate and put this under me before you shoot me so I don't mess up your carpet.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just a little strange. And also, they had found in her bedroom was, like, a few stacks of cash on the bed. I think that maybe her thought process with that was that she was trying to make it seem like, oh, he was coming in, I was getting the money together, and I had to shoot him or something. I don't know what she was doing. However, they found a few $100 bills with the same serial number linked to some of the cash in his pocket. Mm-hmm. So around the same time, a woman 13 miles away who lived in an apartment complex with her 33-year-old son had filed a missing persons report. And once DNA evidence was tested, they found out that this woman's son, and his name was Louis Gumpenberger.
Which, sorry. May he rest in peace.
May he rest in peace. And yeah, that was the man that was found shot to death in Pam's home. His mother claimed that in 2005, Lewis was in a horrible car accident and suffered traumatic brain injury, making him incapable of functioning at the level that Pam was claiming that he was.
Aww.
His mother said he wasn't even able to run.
Oh my God.
So how was he able to, like, rob this woman?
Right.
So 5 days before Lewis was shot, A woman named Carol Alford went down to Charles County Police Department and told them that a woman pulled up in front of her house claiming she was from Chicago and worked for Dateline, claiming her name was Kathy. She offered the opportunity to record a soundbite for Dateline for $1,000 in cash so that there was no paper trail. Carol claimed that she was skeptical because she didn't think that Dateline paid for, like, sound bites or interviews, which she was correct. Right. But she was curious about this woman's MO, so she agreed. And mind you, do you remember when Pam was like, say hi to Kathy for me? Mm-hmm. So she claimed that the woman told her she couldn't bring her phone, keys, wallet, or cigarettes because the producer doesn't like to have any collateral. She claimed that she thought that this was strange, but got in the car anyway.
Is she okay?
Right. And I'm just like, you thought all these things were weird and you still continue to get in the car with this woman?
Yeah, it's so strange.
She claimed that the woman started driving in a different direction than what would have made sense, which I don't know where she thought she was going. Mm-hmm. So she told her she needed to go back to lock her door and get her shoes. And once they got back, she told the woman that she wasn't interested, and the woman kind of pushed and was like, oh, what if I come back in an hour? Would you come help me out? She said no and immediately called the police and gave a description of the woman, and that's kind of when she went down to the station and gave, like, an interview. And they showed her a few different images of, like, different women, and she was positive who it was when she saw Pam Hupp. Like, no doubt in her mind that's who it was. The woman also had cameras out on the front of her house, which got a perfect view of the car that the woman was in and the license plate number, and it was Pam's car. Police had also heard from a man named Brett Charlton, and he had basically the same story as Carol did, about, like, the woman with Dateline and coming and doing a sound bite and stuff like that. And police kind of just presumed that she'd done the same thing to Lewis, and that's kind of what happened. So police had requested a location history from Pam's phone, including the day that Lewis was killed, and it brought up dozens of pins, including a pin at Lewis's apartment complex, and her phone had been there for 3 to 5 minutes.
What are the odds of that, Kaylee?
I know. It's so crazy. So they'd searched four cameras in all of the places her phone had pinged, and along their route they did find quite a few, but there was one in particular that kind of stuck out to police, and there was footage from Heaven Sent Bakery of Pam's car en route, and you can see Lewis in the passenger seat with a baseball cap on. And I couldn't really see this, but I was just watching the Dateline episode, so, like, I feel like it was just, like, I couldn't, like, pause it to actually look.
Right.
I don't know that it definitely, like, you could see that for sure, but that's what they claim. And 1 week after the death of Lewis Gumpenberger, Pam was arrested on first-degree murder charges. So when they'd begun questioning her on all this, including the note, she claimed that she didn't know a Russ, which...
Okay.
Yeah. They knew that was a lie. While they were in the interrogation room, Pam requests a lawyer, and the detectives leave the room at this time, and Pam steals a pen. Like, you see her, like, reach onto the table, and she, like, steals this pen behind a water bottle and, like, sneaks it away, and she starts, like, feeling her neck. When they get back, she asks to go to the bathroom, and they walk into her stabbing her neck and wrists. Yeah.
Okay, psycho.
Like, trying to kill herself, I guess. But she didn't hit any arteries, and most of the wounds were superficial. Detectives and prosecutors kind of thought that this was, like, a publicity stunt to make herself relevant in the media again.
Probably.
And, yeah, she didn't, like, really have an intention to kill herself. So the prosecution decided to go for the death penalty in this case due to the harshness of the crime, just, like, luring somebody in just to kill them.
Yeah, for, like, no reason whatsoever.
Literally, this poor guy.
Like, you're just bored, like, and you want to murder someone.
I feel so bad for this guy and his family. Same. And I think he had kids. Super sad.
Yeah.
The defense claims that there were no witnesses for this crime. Which, okay.
Right.
And there was no surveillance at her home, making everything circumstantial. They challenged everything that the defense came at them with. They claimed that the cell phone records meant nothing because you can't see her physically there. And Pam's trial was delayed over and over again, and there were all these rumors saying that they thought that there wouldn't be a trial, and they were correct. There was no trial.
Hmm.
Pam had accepted a plea deal and took an Alford plea. meaning that she pled guilty due to the fact that the state had enough evidence against her, but she does not admit to any criminal activity and still asserts her innocence. Oh, okay. I hate the concept of an Alford plea. It, like, honestly gets under my skin because what does that accomplish?
Literally nothing.
I mean, you can still prosecute the person, but, like, how can you assert your innocence but plead guilty? I just don't get it. Yeah, I just don't get that. It just irritates me. But regardless, Pam was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole and 28 additional years for criminal activity.
Good, stupid bitch.
So at least, you know, like, and I was watching the Dateline and Russ was like, you know, I just kind of always wanted her to get what I got. And that's exactly what she got, was the same exact sentence as him. So, no, she's not convicted of murdering Betsy, but at least she's spending life in prison. But, as if this hasn't been enough for Pam Hupp, we have one more crime that I want to talk about where, once again, Pam was the last person to see this person alive. So, in 2013... 2 years after Betsy was murdered, on the afternoon of November 1st, Shirley Newman was found on the ground below her third floor balcony with spindles under her body, and it had appeared that she suffered a fatal fall. Shirley Newman was Pam Hupp's mother. Shirley had been living in a retirement community, and on Halloween night, her daughter Pam came to visit her. And as she left, she told the staff that her mother wasn't feeling well and wouldn't be down for dinner that night or breakfast the next morning.
Because she's dead.
Right. So when staff members began to worry the following afternoon, after she hadn't come for lunch either, they went to go check on her, and they noticed that the water in the sink was running and the balcony door was slightly ajar. And the housekeeper had also noticed something, like, knocking around in the wind, and she saw some spindles dislodged from the balcony. And when she looked over, she saw Shirley's body, like, on the ground near the bushes. And at this point in time, Shirley's death was reported as an accident. So, back in 2012, Pam had claimed to police, this is during the entire, Betsy investigation, she had claimed to police that Betsy's insurance money really meant nothing to her because her mom was worth $500,000, and why would she take on somebody stronger than her and not weaker? Yeah. So I just wanted to say that because I thought that that was a little interesting that she said that and then her mom winds up dead a year later.
Yeah.
So in 2016, this information pretty much all comes from Dateline, just to state my source. 3 years after Shirley's death, Dateline did a little snooping. And it was discovered that Shirley had 14 times the recommended dose for a woman her age and size of Ambien found in her bloodstream. That's a lot. Like, 14 times?
A whole lot.
I feel like double, I would be like,
woo!
Yeah. They also noticed that the balcony had seemed extremely sturdy outside. Like, the spindles themselves were, like, metal. So they didn't understand how she could, like, fall and break through that. And they even did a whole, reenactment of this. I, watched it. Mm-hmm. And they put, cement bags on the same spindles. And it took, 450 pounds before the spindles even started bending. And mind you, this woman is maybe 180 pounds max. So even if she were running at full force,
it wouldn't have full speed, been enough.
No, she wouldn't have. I mean, the thought, though, of, somebody else, you have 200 pounds and 200 pounds running at full force and pushing you, then maybe, yeah, that could break it through.
Right.
But the medical examiner finally changed the cause of death from an accident to undetermined. And I know that that's not, that much better, but better than accidental, because it wasn't accidental.
Right.
And, I mean, there's not much information on this one. The estate was divided between Pam and her three siblings, and Pam denies any involvement in her mother's murder, and she also denies any involvement in Betsy's murder. And that's kind of where the Shirley Newman case kind of stands, is there isn't anything else. That's all there is. But I will say, in 2018, after the original prosecutor was voted out of office, Mike Wood took over office, and he has reopened the Betsy Faria case in hopes to prosecute her murderer with new and old evidence. So, yeah, I actually just read something that was, like, an article that came out in October 2019 about them looking back into this case. So,
yeah, she's a fucking psychopath.
Isn't that crazy?
I just, also, she had a husband, too.
She did. And there are, I mean, there's definitely more to go into with that whole thing, but there's, like, recorded jail phone calls between her and her husband. And her husband's always like, oh, everybody says that Pam's a serial killer and blah, blah, blah. Like, he believes in her innocence. And she's like, she talks, like, so nastily about everybody. And she's just a narcissist. I mean.
Did you read the part where she was fired from two previous jobs because she was forging checks?
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's also, I feel like, kind of, you know. She's, like, important because she's, like, super into all this money shit.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't imagine, like, killing anyone, especially my own mother, like, just to have money.
And your friend, just to have...
What, $150,000?
Yeah, and, like, I mean, this is the whole thing with, like, her and Betsy was, like, were they having some sort of a relationship? And she wanted her to leave him and... That's why, like, I just can't comprehend why she would kill her just over the money. I mean, then again, you can't always comprehend things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely strange. And, like, even, like, looking at her pictures, like, you can tell that she's literally a psychopath.
You can see it in her eyes.
She's crazy, yeah. And I don't understand. Have you found anyone that, like, is, like, trying to say she's innocent?
I haven't, and to be honest with this one, I didn't really look into that because, and I do need to, like, continue to look into that, like,
I just wonder.
Right, and I like to look into that because I'm like, prove me wrong. Please, prove me wrong. I really should have looked into that, but I just get so angry with these people sometimes that I'm like, how can you possibly believe that this person is innocent?
Yeah, she's not innocent at all. There's, like, no friggin' way.
I mean, it just can't be a coincidence time and time and time again.
Yeah.
And the only reason that she killed that kid, that guy, was because she was trying to cover up the last crime she did. Why else would she? You're just going to lure this guy in and kill him for fun?
It just doesn't make sense. It's just like, leave it. You know what I mean? Just, why? Because, like,
well,
now
she knew she was... She probably thought she was going to be prosecuted for it. Now that Russ was
maybe
free.
Yeah. And now look at her. She's like,
oh yeah, and they still want to try her.
Sloppy as fuck. Good.
So
what is with all these sloppy murderers?
Two life sentences.
Yeah.
But I mean, they all are. They just all think that they're smarter than everybody. This is just the way that it goes. They think they're smart. They don't think that they're sloppy. And to be honest with you, she could have gotten away with the first one.
Right. She, like, almost did.
Exactly. Well, she did, honestly. If you really think about it, she did.
Yeah.
It just seems like money was her motive. I don't know. But all I do know is that when you're the last person to see three people alive...
You have something to do with all of them.
There's no such thing as coincidence.
Yeah, no. Crazy.
So... That's all I have for this one. Do you have anything to, like, add, or...
I don't. I mean, I just... This is another one that's going to keep me up at night.
I know. But she's in prison. At least she's not walking the streets.
Well, so is Darlie, and I'm...
I know. Well, Darlie is one that, like, really will. And I'm not going to lie, there were times when I was looking into this one that I was like... Because there is a discovery file on this. That's where I got pretty much all my information.
Mm-hmm.
There's a discovery file, and as I was reading it, and mind you, looking back, law enforcement was definitely, like, biased in this, so it's kind of hard, but there were a lot of times that I was like, maybe it was Russ.
I don't think it was at all.
But
even going off of the 911 call,
I know.
I don't think it was him unless he was, like, a super fucking good actor.
No, I know.
But you, like, heard the pain in his voice.
Well, and, like, he had four friends who alibied him.
and friggin' surveillance footage, like, yeah.
Right, yeah, and a receipt that didn't matter.
Apparently, yeah, whatever. It's crazy.
But, yeah, I think that that's all we have for today's episode. Sorry, today's episode went up a day late. it was Thanksgiving weekend, so it's
been a little... And then we had a snow day.
Yes, and we had a snow day. Oh. Two snow days.
Right.
we don't really have a good excuse, but it's going
on. No, we just suck.
A day late. So, yeah. Actually, I think didn't our Friday one go up a day late?
Like, by an hour. It was, like, 1 a.m.
So, I mean, we're just late this week. It's okay.
Yeah, it's fine.
But we will be back on Friday with... Oh, the I finale. Guess it's going to be the reunion, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, the reunion. Why did I say finale?
Yeah, because that was the finale. So we'll be back with the Teen Mom 2 reunion and Teen Mom Young and Pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I don't know if anybody is interested in Unexpected.
Oh, my God. I love... We just started watching it.
When does that come back for a new season?
They don't have an official date. They're saying maybe August 2020.
So is this season, like, still going?
Yeah, season 3 just started in November, it looks like.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So maybe we won't do that one yet.
But we will eventually.
Mm-hmm. And if there are any other reality TV shows that we should do, let us know, because... Teen Mom's starting to die down.
Yeah.
Also, we're going to be out of one Teen Mom starting in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So.
I'm sure we'll figure something out.
We'll need something new.
We should do the polished one or whatever.
Oh, unpolished. We should. That's a good one.
That is so good.
Maybe we'll do that. Maybe we'll incorporate that with Young and Pregnant.
Yeah.
I don't know, but let us know what other series you want us to do. And also, I think that we would really like some requests as to cases we should do.
Yeah.
Because we have some, but, like, a lot of them are very, like, high-profile cases, and I don't want to, like, just only do those, you know? Like, I don't want to I don't want to do them all and then be like, okay, now what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so message us on Instagram, I'd say.
Yeah. Send us a DM.
Mm-hmm.
Wine Crime TV Time Pod.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. Thank you guys so much for listening. We'll be back on Friday with another reality TV episode, and we will be back on Monday with another true crime episode.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Hope you guys like this one. Bye.
Bye.